Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is Neat. It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist. We're getting twisted today again with your questions.
Yeah, so this is our part two of our Q&A episode. You sent us so many amazing questions that we are still working through them.
Mm-hmm. We're not even going to finish them all on this episode. There's going to be more in the future.
So some were just their own episodes. So yeah. If you don't hear your question this episode, you're probably just getting a whole episode.
Lucky you.
Yeah. But let's just, we got a lot to get through. Let's just get right into it.
Yeah, let's jump right in. All right, so this first question comes from Luke. Heyo! I like it when people say that. Heyo, Luke. Heyo, the Brooklyn Botanical Garden had a cider tasting event last weekend. I'm assuming this was a while ago, so not this past weekend. During which I picked up a bottle of Applejack and a bottle of unfiltered cider. I also picked up a bottle of spicy honey from the gift shop, and on the label it suggests using it in a cocktail. Got any ideas for a cocktail with Applejack and spicy honey? This is really timely because, you know, it's September now.
Yeah.
It's fall.
Yeah, we are in fall time, so this is a perfect question to kick off this episode. And I would say, first off, I'm jealous because all of that sounds awesome and delicious.
Yeah, I don't think the museum is open like that right
now. No, it is not. I get emails from them. I think that they're allowing, like, limited entry or something.
Oh.
I don't know. But yeah, maybe you still have these things around, maybe not, but it's a great question anyway. I would say that the most obvious, like, simple answer to me would be, like, basically an Applejack sour.
Would you make a syrup with the spicy honey?
Yeah, so a honey syrup is really easy to make. You don't want to work with honey as is, because as you add it to, like, a chilled shaker, it's going to seize up. It's not going to dilute in your drink the way you want it to. So you want to add some more viscosity to it. So for honey, we usually do it two parts honey to one part water.
Okay.
So you would just take your honey, like, you know, like a cup of your honey with a half cup of water on the stove, and just kind of bring it up warm enough so that it all mix, like, combines together. And then there you go. You got a honey syrup.
Nice.
And then I would mix that honey syrup then with, like, 2 ounces of Applejack, 3/4 ounce of your honey syrup, and 3/4 ounces of lemon. You could add some Ango in there for sure. You could throw an egg white in there if you wanted to be, you know, like, do a proper sour. And then shake it, strain it into a coupe. Have, like, a cool fall Applejack sour.
Ooh, that sounds delicious.
Yeah. I think also that, you know, as we move into colder months, that sounds like two ingredients that I would absolutely want in a hot toddy.
Ooh.
Just, you know, using your Applejack as your base, some lemon juice, some of that. You wouldn't have to dilute the honey in that build. I like tea in my hot toddy. I mean, you know, usually toddies are just hot water, some sort of sweetener, some sort of citrus, and some sort of booze.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like, with all of that kind of that spice and stuff, I think you could put, like, a really nice, like, a English breakfast tea bag in there and just add some tannins. But and then also you could kind of do, I mean, Applejack, I always think, like, a Jack Rose.
Oh, yeah.
That's, like, the classic Applejack cocktail. But I think, because that's made with grenadine, if you want to use that spiced honey in there, you could maybe do, so you don't have to bother with getting, like, nice grenadine, you could maybe do some pomegranate juice, keep it in that fall feeling, you know?
Oh, and, like, make a kind of grenadine adjacent thing with the spicy honey and pomegranate juice.
Yeah.
Oh, I love,
like,
that.
Like, instead of cutting your honey with water for a syrup, cut your honey with some pomegranate juice and create, like, spiced honey pomegranate grenadine, which would be really good.
That would be fucking delicious.
I think that would be super good. And then that's that same 2/3, 3/4, 3/4, but you're just using your honey, grenadine, and Applejack and lemon.
Yeah, nice. Quite a lot of things you can do.
Yeah, and those are all pretty simple. You could definitely, there are more complicated drinks that I think you could throw those things in, but sometimes when you've just got two really cool ingredients, I just think build your drinks specifically around those, you know?
Mm-hmm. Awesome. This next question is from Desmond. I just came out as queer. Congratulations. Good for you.
Welcome.
And I'm wondering if there are any specific drinks that have a long gay history.
Oh, a long gay history. gay cocktails, I did some research into this because I was curious, too, if I could find any historically, historically gay bartenders that made cocktails, that I think that would qualify as, gay cocktails.
Absolutely.
But we're also talking about, the era of classic cocktails also being an era when a lot of people were in the closet. Yeah. So are some of our classics possibly made by gay bartenders? Maybe, but...
Absolutely. I'm sure.
Not any that we can name. I do think it's worth noting that Prohibition... If you listen to our first Pride episode, I talked about a time period known as the Pansy Craze, which
yes.
was when it was very, it was the chic, cool thing to do to go basically see drag shows. You saw, drag kings mm-hmm. and drag queens, and... It was very in, and it was what, all the young people did. And this overlapped with Prohibition. So you had these, speakeasy bars where people were drinking, these cocktails that were... It was all illegal. It was all, bathtub gin and yeah. with all these different mixers. So that's all of those Prohibition-era cocktails that were had when you had queer culture. Also, the Harlem Renaissance. So you had, black culture. And then you also had, the normies engaging in all of this and embracing all of this.
The tourists.
Yes. So I kind of like to think everything that came out of Prohibition is a little gay.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair.
Or at least it was more tolerant. But I will say one cocktail we can actually claim.
Oh.
There's one.
Okay.
I would say we can claim. Is the Cosmopolitan.
It's not because of Sex and the City,
no,
is it?
No.
That would be really disappointing.
That's not. Sex and the City, despite how much it preyed upon gay culture, it was very disrespectful to it.
Yep. Absolutely.
And it's not just because I think inherently the Cosmopolitan is a gay drink to order.
No?
It absolutely is. But its origins are in the late 80s, and there's conflicting origin stories, but they both come from West Coast and East Coast queer culture.
Okay.
There are a lot of San Francisco bartenders and bargoers that said that it was invented in San Francisco in the late 80s. The East Coast story, which has a bit more specificity, is that you had there's a lot of gay culture presence in Provincetown in Massachusetts.
Oh.
And that you had people that were there drinking. They wanted kamikazes, but the cranberries are local there. So okay. They threw some cranberry juice in a kamikaze, which is more or less a cosmopolitan. That's how the Cosmopolitan was born. And it caught on as a very cool, hip thing to order in the gay scene in New York City.
Okay.
And then that's where you then get it getting into the hands of the Sex and the City ladies, which definitely made it very popular, across the nation. But I mean, I think that makes sense because they were trendy, affluent white ladies in the 90s.
Right.
Taking advantage of queer culture, but also not engaging with it.
Yeah.
It was very that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds that, two plus two. Yep. That adds up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think we can happily claim the Cosmo, which I think is a much maligned drink, but a well-made Cosmo is really good. I mean, it's a sour with some cranberry juice, that balances it out.
Mm-hmm.
I did do a little bit of research into, what drinks do sell most in gay bars. And, the stuff...
Exciting new research.
Well, the stuff that is, most popular in gay bars, it's not really surprising because it's just what's popular in clubs. And
okay.
So much of, gay bar culture is club culture.
Vodka soda,
yeah,
gin and tonic.
I would love, an all gay, prohibition style cocktail bar.
Ooh.
Super nerdy but super gay. If those exist out, and I'm sure they do somewhere, it's just more prevalent gay bars, or they're more divey, I think. They're
yeah.
more party bars.
Okay.
And so what you find popular there is what you find popular in all party bars. Vodka sodas and gin and tonics, mm-hmm. and
things
vodka
that are
cran.
Really easy to yell to a bartender over techno music.
Absolutely. Things you can drink eight of in a night, and you're not going to be too wasted, and you're going to stay somewhat hydrated. I mean, vodka Red Bull.
Yeah.
Vodka Red Bull is hugely popular in gay bars. I don't... I hate that for us.
Yeah, I mean, you gotta, you know, when you're a creature of the night, you gotta stay up.
You gotta stay up. I did find, this is a recipe from 2018, but I thought it was cool because one of the main bartenders from Stonewall actually did a cocktail for Esquire.
Ooh.
A bartender by the name of Mel Albaladejo created the cocktail Off the Wall. It's like, you know, Stoli cucumber, pomegranate, simple syrup, lime. There's some ginger and mint in there. If you think about it, it's also Cosmo adjacent.
Uh-huh.
It fits with a lot of the things that are popular in like gay cocktails, but it's definitely elevated. So I think it's cool. The recipe specifically is on the Esquire website.
Nice.
You know, made by one of the like house Stonewall bartenders. So
sounds really good. Rad.
Yeah.
Sounds gay. I'm in. Okay. So next question's from Stephanie. And Stephanie says, I just need to lean back because right. I do want to give it the gravitas. Hims cups! They confound me and I love them.
I love the way this question is asked because it's not really a question. It's just, this is a statement. Okay, so I'm gonna answer this in a few ways.
And how do you answer a question that's not a question?
Well, I think what you mean is like, I don't know really what they are. And that's, you're not wrong in that because nobody really knows what they are.
I don't know.
Or at least people can't agree with what they are.
Is it a cup?
Well, there's a cup involved, and okay. That you put it in a cup.
Okay.
All right. So, to understand the Pimm's Cup cocktail, we must first understand the most important ingredient, which is Pimm's Number One. That is the liqueur that is the base for a Pimm's Cup. So, the name comes from the ingredient. Now, Pimm's is what the British call a fruit cup. Not like the thing you got after soccer practice. Like, no.
With the gelatin and no. The little peaches.
That is, it's a base spirit, usually gin, that's flavored with herbs, spices, fruits, and botanicals. And it's proofed down to like a lower strength. And then it's usually meant to be mixed with something in like a highball. So
okay.
You would mix a fruit cup with soda or lemonade or tonic. And it's just kind of a simple like cocktail build.
Probably responsible that that's a different kind of fruit cup than you don't give that to the soccer players.
I mean, I think it would be really refreshing after a game of soccer, but just not for like 8-year-olds.
Right.
Yeah. I agree.
Then you just got a bunch of drunk 8-year-olds.
Oh, no. That's a nuisance. When you got a bunch of drunk 8-year-olds. No. It'd be the worst soccer parent.
Yeah.
So that's in the technically what Pimm's, the liqueur, gets categorized. But Pimm's origin dates back to like 1820s, 1830s. A man by the name of James Pimm. He was the proprietor of an oyster bar.
Mm.
It was very popular at the time, like to have alcohol-based tonics available for medicinal purposes. And so he decided to make one for his bar, like just a house tonic, basically a house liqueur. So he designed, you know, his first one in more of a traditional way with gin as the base, and he just called it Pimm's Number One Cup, because cup was just like, yeah, this is the house cup of stuff, you know.
Yeah,
and
it's number one
exactly, and
undefeated.
And number one because he had a large tanker that he had it in, and it was number one. It was
nice.
The first one. So it was a success. Like, other bars wanted to be able to have Pimm's Number One. That eventually led to enough demand to merit its own distillery by 1859. And he also launched a companion chain of Pimm's oyster houses from that. The brand expanded further in like the next century. They had Pimm's One, but they also had 2 through 6. And the big difference was that they all had different base spirits and different spice builds. You know, there was like a Scotch Pimm's and a Vodka Pimm's, a Brandy Pimm's, just like all these different versions of Pimm's. By like the 1960s, 1970s, Pimm's sales had largely dropped, so they kind of reduced the number of Pimm's available back down to that original number one.
Mm-hmm.
The company Pimm's had changed hand a few times by now. They recently brought back like Pimm's Number Three, which is the brandy-based one, as like a winter Pimm's. So that's still seasonally available in some places. I don't know if we get it stateside. But yeah, so when we talk about Pimm's liqueur, it started out as sort of a health tonic liqueur, gained popularity, has been around for a while. Now, where did the cocktail come from?
Yeah.
Fruit cups had already been a thing in the UK. Like, that was already a normal thing you'd do with something like a Pimm's. There are a lot of other products available there made in the same family. So to say that it started in America, a Pimm's Cup cocktail, is absolutely wrong. They were already around in the 1800s, the 1900s. People were drinking what is basically a Pimm's Cup.
Mm-hmm.
But it was in the 1940s in America, in New Orleans specifically, that the Pimm's Cup kind of got entered into the pantheon of like popular cocktails. So the story goes with that. There was a bar owner at a prominent bar in the French Quarter called the Napoleon House. Basically, his patrons were just getting too drunk too early in the evening, and he wasn't getting enough money out of them because, no,
you gotta stretch it out.
Exactly. So he wanted to start serving a cocktail that would be lower alcohol, but people would really dig. And at some point, somehow he had learned of the existence of fruit cups, Pimm's cups, in the UK. He did not come up with this on his own. The New Orleans has claimed it since. It had already been out there, but he'd come in contact with the idea. I mean, the fact that he had Pimm's means that it wasn't a wildly distributed thing. So he started serving Pimm's cups. And now in the UK, you'd get it with sparkling lemonade. As it kind of became a staple in America, it became more associated with like Sprite or 7-Up.
Okay.
Yeah. This New Orleans Pimm's cup became known as like the Pimm's cup and still gets referenced and credit for the invention of the drink.
Okay.
That's kind of what proliferated the idea of a Pimm's cup, and it was based on like how they made it in New Orleans. But if you look at the recipes now, and I think this is the part of Stephanie's questions about how they confound you.
Okay.
Is that I looked at maybe 15 recipes just to confirm what I previously believed before doing this episode. And none of them agree on what's in a Pimm's cup outside of Pimm's and ice. Like, we get that. That's there. Definitely great. Pimm's, definitely ice.
Cool.
And the proportions are generally the same. It's like one part Pimm's to three part something. But that something can be Sprite. It could be ginger ale. It could be ginger beer. It could be lemonade. It could be lemonade, but I mean that in the British interpretation of lemonade, which is like a sparkling soda that is kind of like a tart Sprite. So, you know, what goes in it to stretch it out with the Pimm's, that differs. Mm-hmm. Some people throw tonic in there. And then even like the garnishes, you know, some say mint and cucumbers are iconic and necessary. Some recipes call for berries, strawberries specifically, all berries, sliced apple, like, you know, different herbs.
Completely different things.
Yeah. And then, you know, some will call for a little bit of citrus in there, like a little bit of lemon juice on top of everything else, or mm-hmm. or some more gin. Here's your gin.
Why
add
not?
Some gin.
Just more gin.
Some call for bitters. So I even saw one that called for triple sec randomly.
Oh,
yeah.
That is random.
So it is a confounding drink in that, you know, the idea of it is Pimm's number one. The liqueur, the fruit cup, stretched out with something to make it a highball, and then full of some sort of fruit or vegetation. But all of those are just sort of up for interpretation.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. So I did look specifically at the Pimm's number one website to see what they said.
What did they say?
And they, I mean, their recipe was easily one of the most simple ones I looked at. Like, they say it's a one part Pimm's to three parts lemonade. Add strawberry, orange, cucumber, and a sprig of mint.
Well,
that is theirs.
That sounds nice.
And I think that, now I do think that the lemonade they're saying there is the clear lemonade soda that you find in the UK.
Right. Okay, yeah, because that's different.
Yeah. And I would argue, I do think a key element of a Pimm's cup in modern day is that it has some sort of bubble to it.
Yeah. You gotta have some bubbles.
Yes. But if you use bubbles as in like sparkling wine, then it's a Pimm's cup Royale.
Oh.
Mm, yeah.
All
so,
right.
Good to know.
Glad they thought of that.
Now, I will say, if this all sounds like a lot, we will be trying different variations of the Pimm's cup to see what we like. Because ultimately, it's up to you. Yeah, if you like your Pimm's cup with ginger ale, you're not wrong. If you like your Pimm's cup with Sprite, you're not wrong. If you like your Pimm's cup with lemonade, you're still not wrong.
Yeah, not technically.
No.
Yeah. So. Okay, cool. Jonathan asked, what's the difference between ginger ale versus ginger beer? And why are they called that if they're not alcoholic? I identify with this question. I agree with it. I love ginger ale and ginger beer especially. But I have always wondered about this. And I have been, personally, I have been carded many times when trying to purchase ginger beer. Because I think there's just so little awareness.
Mm, yeah.
Because it's called beer, so, you know, but there is some types of ginger beer that's alcoholic now.
Yes.
But they did it on purpose.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. The key difference between ginger beer and ginger ale is that ginger beer is fermented.
Okay.
You take ginger, sugar, and water, and you ferment it together. So the bubbles that are inherent there are naturally caused from fermentation, and you do get an alcohol content.
Really?
Like, very, very low. Like, okay. You can drive it up. And, like, when we're talking, like, ginger beer dates back to the 1800s, originated in England in the 1800s, and that ginger beer maybe clocked in around, like, 3-4% alcohol. It had a little bit of alcohol in it.
Like a kombucha.
Yeah. Now, the difference between ginger beer and ginger ale is that ginger ale is carbonated water. So the carbonation comes from, like, a carbonation process, like, okay, a soda, that's been flavored with, nowadays it's ginger corn syrup.
Yeah.
But even, you know, old school ginger ale was just a ginger flavored and sweetened carbonated water.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So to look at the history of the two products, ginger beer is the older of the two. Dates back to the 1800s. In origin, it had a little bit of alcohol, a very strong ginger character, and a very loose bubble structure. Not necessarily like a sparkling beverage. Really similar to, like, the origins of beer. And okay. We talk about, like, yeah, you know, like the kind of bread beer, the very basic,
yeah,
beer.
Yeah, okay.
Now, as far as ginger ale goes, you get something called ginger ale in the 1850s. Sometimes Ireland gets credited for inventing ginger ale, but this is still a fermented product.
Okay.
It's still something they're fermenting ginger in with sugar and water and getting a byproduct, just kind of filtering it more. Now, mm-hmm, ginger ale as we know it today was invented in 1907 by a Canadian by the name of John J. McLaughlin, who created a lighter, drier, filtered, ginger-flavored carbonated soda that would become known as Canada Dry.
Oh, I like that one.
So Canada Dry is the original ginger ale. And that divide between what is ginger ale and what is ginger beer in modern times is a little bit clearer. It's separated pretty strongly in. Ginger ale is a soda. Ginger beer is a fermented beverage.
Really?
The ginger beer that you see on the market that has no alcohol, obviously they've taken steps to either remove the alcohol or ferment it in a way that doesn't produce measurable amounts of alcohol.
Okay.
And a lot of them will have extra carbonation added to it on the back end to make it that, like, really tight bubble structure that we expect from a soda.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a good question to point out just some cocktail terminology that goes along with this. The cocktail we most commonly associate with ginger beer, Moscow Mule.
Yeah.
So if you don't have ginger beer, if you only have ginger ale, that's fine, but that's a buck. That's Moscow buck, a vodka buck.
Oh.
So we actually use
like an adolescent. Okay.
It's a little baby.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wait, wait, no.
I don't think that's...
Okay, it's just
different. Look, I only know alcohol stuff. I don't know animal shit.
Yeah, okay. I was thinking of... but a buck is not a adolescent mule. It's just a different... It's a different species.
A buck
species.
Is a type of deer, right?
It's a male deer, yeah.
So I don't know why a ginger beer drink is a mule and a... I mean, I don't know, like, comparatively to the animals, but...
I mean, I imagine a mule has a stronger kick, you know?
Maybe that's why. But yeah, I just...
You know what
just
I mean by a stronger kick?
Well, that it'll kick you.
It can kick.
But it also is stronger than the ginger.
Yep. Yeah, there it is.
I got it. I feel like that's discrediting the bucks, though, you know?
I mean, they got a stronger head.
Well.
Because the antlers.
All right. I don't know.
And it would be fizzier, so it would. It
works. Oh, it's got a stronger head. I see. Okay.
See, I wasn't just... I had a pun in the works, you know? Like, it wasn't...
It's funny. The way that I learned this difference was because at one bar I worked at, we had a whiteboard in the basement where people would write cocktail ideas. And, somebody wrote up there a cocktail. I think the name was Buck Me, and it was Ahaha. It's a play on words, and included ginger beer in it. And one of the other bartenders wrote a very angry message in response, not about like the kind of obscene name, but being like, "Your terminology is wrong, and here's why."
So it should be Mule Me.
Exactly, which doesn't make sense. Or make it ginger ale. But I was like, is that true? Like, ask one of the owners. It's like, actually, yes, that's true. Like, oh, okay. Yeah, so okay. I learned something.
Well, there you go.
Just think of that. Like,
there you go.
I'm not offended that you want to call a cocktail Buck Me. I'm just offended that you aren't using it right.
Yeah, it's going to be confusing. People aren't going to know what they're getting.
No.
I respect that. I like that. Nice question.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. This next question is from Michael. Where does happy hour come from? It's such an ubiquitous, I think that's the first time I've said ubiquitous out loud. Ubiquitous.
Ubiquitous.
Yeah, ubiquitous thing. Yep. I've heard it said so many times, I've never tried to use it in a sentence. Let me try again.
Ubiquitous.
It's such a ubiquitous thing that you don't really think about where it came from.
The concept of happy hour, if we break it down into what is it, it's like having drinks after you get done with your workday, right? That concept has been like an aperitif after work, kind of a wind down. That's been a part of different cultures and customs around the world, frankly, as long as we've had some idea of an industrial workday. So I won't give credit for the concept of happy hour to who I'm going to give credit to the phrase happy hour. The idea has been around. The idea has been ubiquitous for a very long time. But the term happy hour comes to us from the U.S. Navy.
Oh.
So in the early 20th century, it was birthed on the USS Arkansas. They began...
Does Arkansas have a navy? Where is Arkansas?
No, they have a boat. The USS Arkansas is a boat.
Why would they name it Arkansas? It's a landlocked state.
Tons of states have U.S. Like, there's a USS West Virginia.
Why, though? Okay.
Does Arkansas have a navy?
Carry on.
So it was birthed on the USS Arkansas. They began implementing a program. It was just a happy hour program is what they called it. It was basically just to keep the troops on the seas kind of occupied in midday when they start to get kind of bored and rowdy.
Just give them booze?
Well, it was more of like a, you know, like an entertainment program. They would have like boxing and dancing and music. As just to kind of like, the day's almost done, let's have a little wind down hour. And alcohol was around, but that's, you know, it was just...
We're talking about the Navy.
Yeah,
you're trying to tell me it wasn't drinking. A focal point?
And they were definitely drinking, but, you know, the program was specifically, we'll give you something to look forward to at the end of your day.
Okay.
A little relaxation.
Well, that's nice.
The idea caught on throughout the Navy and the military at large. So it wasn't just the USS Arkansas that was having happy hours.
I'm glad.
Especially like post-World War I, it just kind of became like a regular thing. And that idea, of course, proliferated outside of the military as well. But one of the big things that actually aided the idea of happy hour cementing itself in like the American mindset is Prohibition.
Oh.
Of course. Prohibition pops up.
Always.
Because a lot of people would want to go out to dinner, but most restaurants were dry. So you'd meet up somewhere and have a happy hour or two where you'd have some drinks and then go to your restaurant and have some food because you already got your drinking done.
That's why it's so early. Mm-hmm. Okay, gotcha.
And that became such a regular thing as like businesses for like both speakeasies, like bars that, you know, were illegally operated, and just things that people did at their house. You just have your friends over for a happy hour and then go out to eat.
Oh, it's the original pregame.
Yeah, exactly. So even after Prohibition, a lot of restaurants wanted to capitalize on that idea. And so they started offering cheap drinks and snacks at like a immediately post-work hour to get people out and drinking earlier. Because that's the thing they realized is like if people start coming earlier and drinking, they drink longer.
Oh.
Yeah. So the idea of drinking in the late afternoon, it's been around for a very long time. But the term happy hour comes to us from the 20th century in America.
All right.
Now, it is worth noting that a lot of places do not consider happy hour to be so happy.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's banned in, Alaska, Delaware, Hawaii, Indiana, Maine, Massachusetts, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, Utah, and Vermont.
Wow.
Now, that doesn't mean you can't drink at 5 o'clock. It just means that bars can't run promotions where they sell cheaper drinks at an hour of the day than the rest of the day.
Okay.
It's kind of like the same. We have like that brunch rule of like you can't have bottomless things for an extended period of times. Mm-hmm. Ireland and the UK both have similar restrictions on happy hour. Canada doesn't outlaw them outright, but it comes with a lot of like caveats of there's a certain period of time you can do it. And so
that's funny, just to use the language basically,
yeah,
as a promotion.
Well, and a lot of them came about as a part of an anti-drinking campaign, because right. it makes sense, because we all know this: if you sit down at a bar to have a couple half off cocktails at 5, the likelihood that you're gonna stay and have some more
even after happy hour is done.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of the evil math of the industry. So if I can get you to have 2 cocktails, I can definitely get you to have a third.
Yep, that's true.
Oh, happy hour. Happy for some.
Sad for others. Okay, well, next question comes from Lauren. Are there any bar/cocktail superstitions?
Well, there are a lot of drink-related superstitions from around the world. I think every culture has their own. We talked a lot about them on an episode we did last October, specifically about bar myths,
yes,
and superstitions.
I believe it's called Superstitions.
Ah, there you go.
I think Superstitions is in the name,
yes,
somewhere.
So check out that episode if you haven't heard it yet. We talk a lot more in depth about them. But as far as like some of the most popular ones, mm-hmm, I've got a little top 3 for you.
Ooh, give me your top 3.
The things that I come in contact the most, yeah. They all center around toasting, which is a very like superstitious heavy,
yes,
like we all have to follow these rules or bad, mm-hmm, things will happen. Obviously, the first one is that when you're toasting, you have to maintain eye contact with the people that you're toasting to,
mm-hmm,
or face a decade of bad sex,
yeah,
sometimes more, sometimes less, but a decent amount of time of bad sex.
In some cultures, is it like bad sex forever?
Yeah, just forever bad sex. You did not look somebody in the eye while you were toasting your glass, and that was it.
This is what you deserve.
Yeah. Tapping your glass on the bar before consuming your drink.
That's a big one.
Yeah, I do it. We both do it.
Yep. It gets the demons out of your drink.
Well, there are a couple like reasons for it, but the superstitious reason is that like ghosts will haunt the wood of the bar, and so,
yeah,
that tap scares them away. So when you toast, it's just, you know, you and your beloved comrades. There's no ghosts invading your toast.
Yeah, it's like knock on wood.
Yeah, you don't want a ghost toast.
No.
I want a ghost toast.
Get that ghost out of your toast.
Well, I want ghosts that I invited to my toast.
Are you inviting ghosts?
Not right now. I'm just saying, like, I'm okay with doing a toast with a ghost. I just want to know that ghost is there, and I want to know that he's a chill dude.
I don't want to know that you're here. If there are any ghosts present,
no.
I don't.
Okay,
do not
I'm
make
sorry.
Yourself known.
All right. Well, the third one is toasting with either a glass of water or an empty glass.
Terrible.
Either way, you're kind of damning all of the other people in the toast to hell. So don't do that.
Yeah, don't do that. I wonder about, is it like, sometimes if I don't have a drink to toast with, or like I, you know, like my friends are doing around and I've decided to stop drinking or just like wait a while, whatever, I'll like kind of with my pinky, like a little like fake glass, like,
I mean,
it's not a water or a empty glass. It's just my hand holding an invisible glass.
To me, there's a difference between the empty glass and the water glass. And that goes back to history in that the empty glass is largely considered just, it's rude. It's rude,
okay,
to your friends. It's rude to the integrity of the toast.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of cultures, it's a slap in the face as far as manners go. But that's not superstitious. That's just bad manners.
Mm-hmm.
The water glass specifically comes from the tradition of toasting to the dead with water, because the water represents the river Styx.
Oh.
So you're basically wishing them safe passage into the afterlife. So introducing a water glass to a toast among friends is kind of wishing death, safe passage unto death to everybody in that circle.
Okay,
so
definitely don't do that.
Yeah, I think it's the, when I see somebody just hold up like a hand or a glass that doesn't have anything in it, like, I think it's not my culture to think it's a faux pas. We talked a bit about, like, that's very much like in Japanese drinking culture, in Korean drinking culture, Chinese drinking culture, it's very rude.
Mm-hmm.
That's not my culture, so I don't mind it. But I do think the water glass to me makes me go, oh, I'm not gonna do that. I'm not gonna toast you.
No.
Not that my culture is also like the river Styx, but, you know, I don't know.
No, yeah, no,
that's
it just feels, that's a superstition that feels like it's just, it's too superstitious.
Yeah.
You can't mess with that stuff.
And I think you can be safe just like, you know, if you really just want to behave well in a toast, make eye contact, tap your glass, and have something other than water in your glass. Doesn't have to be alcohol, you know.
Okay.
Ask the bar. It's like, you know, winding down at the end of the night, everyone's doing a shot, you don't want one, just ask for a little Coke or something.
Okay.
I don't think any demons are going to jump in that glass. I think it's okay.
No, the Coke would kill them. It would dissolve. Have you seen Coke dissolve a tooth? It would dissolve the demon.
Oh, that's how... Because demons are made of teeth.
Yes.
Oh, that's a horrible visual.
They're mostly teeth. Have you seen a demon?
Can you imagine a demon made of all teeth? Like little teeth, like individual teeth, but it's just all teeth? Because now that's all I'm going to think about
stop,
for a while.
Stop thinking about it. Okay, here's another question. Okay, Sarah says, hello, I recently inherited a crystal ship's decanter from my grandfather, which inspired me to buy two more vintage decanters. Oh, starting a collection. I like. I was hoping you could help me with a question. What is the point of decanters? This seems like a question to be asking a little late. You've got three now.
Maybe now's the right time to ask.
Okay, sure. Should I put my brandy in one? Will I need to drink it faster if it's decanted? What other things can I put in my decanters? Will it make them taste any different? Or will it just make me look like I'm pretending I'm in Mad Men? Disclaimer, I have never seen a single episode of Mad Men. Don't worry, I stopped watching, like, second season. So, what's the deal with decanters?
Well, this is a great question, because I do think... I personally would say I have a decanter in my house because it's pretty, so I'm not anti-decanter. Now, it is a little tricky as to if it does any good or not, so we'll break it down. As far as what is the point of decanters, it is to decant some sort of liquor. Traditionally, wine is what we want to decant. And we want to decant wine for two reasons. The first is that when we transfer wine from a bottle to a decanter, we're trying to leave behind that little bit of wine at the bottom that might have sediment in it. Ooh. So you're trying to separate the wine from the sediment that naturally gathers in a bottle. Because as soon as you tip that bottle over to pour a glass, you're going to get sediment mixed in it. So We don't want to drink the sediment. The second reason that we decant wine is to oxidize the wine slightly.
Oh, yeah.
We're introducing oxygen to the wine. It opens it up. It's the same reason you swirl your wine in a glass. Mm-hmm. It opens it up.
Yeah.
And that makes you taste more of the wine. Now, I will say there are sommeliers out there that are very against decanting wine. They say that as much as the oxidation adds flavor, you're also losing things. So it's kind of iffy on if decanting wine is a thing that you ultimately want to do. I am not a sommelier, so I will not weigh in on that. But it's important to note. And when you decant wine, you also are doing it like with the top off. Like it's not a sealed decanter when you're decanting wine. It's open and it's assuming you're going to consume that wine that evening.
Mm.
You're not going to let wine decant like overnight.
No.
And then go back and drink it.
It goes bad.
Yeah. You don't want overly oxidized wine. So it
turns into vinegar, right?
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah.
If you have a decanter and you want to know something else you can put in it, you can decant wine in a decanter. But, you know, it's to drink that night. Now, for spirits, the issue is, does it do anything? And that's kind of up for debate.
Okay.
Does it make it look cool? Absolutely. And yes. That's why I have one, because I think it looks really cool. Yes. Does it do any damage or shorten the lifespan of your spirit? Kind of depends on what kind of decanter you have. If your decanter has like an airtight seal, it's the same as having it in a bottle. It's no better or worse. Now, obviously, most decanters are clear, so the exposure to light causes spirits to break down a little faster than if it's in like a green glass bottle. But when we're talking like full alcohol spirits, that's not really going to damage it too much. If you've got one of those, like mine is a glass decanter with like a glass cork in it, and that's going to allow a little bit of oxygen in. Some people will claim that that's going to open up like a whiskey or brandy over time. I don't really know if it does that. But if you don't have a top, if you've got like a wine decanter that doesn't have a top or doesn't have a very tight seal, that's the thing that you really don't want to put your nice booze in, because it's going to evaporate. So you could lose some booze.
Damn.
So you don't want that to happen, but that's not going to happen if you've got a nice seal on your decanter. And really, as long as you drink it within a month, it's perfectly fine. So
cool.
The short answer is they don't do anything bad necessarily to your spirits, and they definitely look really cool.
Okay.
I really enjoy having one in my life, so... And if you have a bottle of wine, you can always, you know, if you got a decanter that you don't have anything in, you can always play around with trying some wine decanted.
Yeah.
Okay. You want to let it open up for like 10 to the high end, like 30 minutes before you drink it, but like 10 to 15 is fine.
Okay. I dig it. I won't knock it. Austin asks, what are your to-go drinks when visiting a new bar that doesn't have a particularly exciting cocktail menu?
Interesting. I'm going to preface this by saying that I am perpetually, like, over-concerned with burdening other bartenders.
Okay.
Like, more than a normal patron I would ever want to be. But that's just me. So I think my thought process is a little bit more intense than yours needs to be. Mainly, I want to order something that the bartender is comfortable making. This is assuming that we want a cocktail, we're going and we know we want to order a cocktail. First off, I would check out that, even if it's not an exciting cocktail menu, I'd kind of give it a once over to see. Usually you can look at a cocktail and tell what kind of bar it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you see a lot of, like, flavored vodka on the menu, that's not to be insulting to that, but you know, like a lot of like sour mix and flavored vodkas and sprites and cokes and cocktails, then it's not necessarily like gonna be able to make me an amazing old fashioned or like a classic daiquiri or something like that. So I might kind of look at that menu as a bit of a tell to how stocked that bartender is. I'm also probably gonna do like a quick check, just look around the bar and see, like, do they have like garnishes and fresh fruit and like juices, or are they working with sour mix and like, you know, like not much else.
That's a good point.
Yeah, because I don't want to, like, if I look around a bar and I see, like, maybe I don't want anything in the cocktail menu, but they have stuff to make classics, like, I'll go with like a safe order of like a daiquiri or an old fashioned. Like, I love a rye old fashioned. That's usually my go-to, and I think, you know, all that bartender needs is rye, bitters, and something sweet.
Yeah.
And a twist. So that's true. It's a pretty basic order.
That's a good twist. Yeah, I was going to say, mine is pretty basic, but you haven't mentioned it yet, but I typically, my go-to would be like a margarita, because that's a classic cocktail. Like, if you're a bartender, you should know how to make a margarita, and most bars have at least decent ingredients to make it. You know,
that's actually a good call, because I also, and this is just me and my palate, but a poorly made margarita, meaning like a margarita made of sour mix,
that's a big tell.
I don't hate it,
really.
Like, of all the cocktails out there that I think if you make them wrong they're gonna taste really bad, I mean, it's also just, it's how I grew up. Like, like, cheap pre-made margarita mix is flavor and a place for me. It's like being at Applebee's with my sister. Yeah. Or like, you know, like,
some places make their own mix, too.
Yeah.
That's like the place that I grew up. There's a place in Ohio called Elsa's, and they have like, they make their own margarita mix, and they also sell it in the grocery store.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it's good. Yeah. It's called Bad Juan.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's what their margaritas are called. So they're technically, they're not margaritas. They're Bad Juans, but they're like, all they're right, margaritas made with their special mix.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Well, that would lead me to my next bit of advice, which is, if your bartender's not too busy, if you can take a second to be like, what's good here? What do you like to make? Yeah. Or what are you all known for? If you know you want a cocktail, sometimes, even if that cocktail menu doesn't look great, sometimes a bar just does something just so fucking right, and you don't know that until you maybe just like inquire. Like,
yeah.
And I always want a bartender to make something for me that they're excited to make.
Yeah,
and if
that's a good point.
Yeah, you know, you kind of gauge what kind of bar you're in, and then, you know, kind of see what you can and can't order based on that. And I would say a big rule, because I feel like on this podcast, you know, we're informing you about a lot of really cool esoteric drinks or like classic drinks that are a little lost, and that's great. But a lot of these drinks, not every bar is going to be equipped to make, or not every bartender will necessarily know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the big rules for me is that no matter how much, like, I love a Corpse Reviver or a Last Word or an Aviation,
I don't expect anyone to know that.
And I'm not going to order one of those unless, you know, if I walk in and there's like apothecary bottles and suspenders and tiny mustaches and all of that, I'm like, okay, they have a cocktail menu that looks like an encyclopedia. Okay, maybe it's safe to order a Last Word here.
Right.
And not stress anybody out. But even with like classics like that, I never want to stress out a bartender with something that's a little bit outside of the realm of things they'd be expected to make. And you never know if there's like a manager listening who doesn't know if they should or should be able to make that or what. I don't know.
Yeah.
When there's plenty of standards that I could look around at like the three ingredients they need to make and be like, okay, they can make that. It's easy and it's standard. Yeah, I would always rather not.
I always feel really terrible if I were to ask for something and then I see like the bartender like Googling it.
Yeah.
Like that feels really sad because like that's not like a fun journey for us both to be on. Like,
right.
Sometimes a bartender will be like, oh, I'm not familiar with that. Like, what's in it? And more often than not, like, you know, maybe I've had it and I don't remember what's in it. I can tell you. And I would have to look it up too. So like that, I figure that's not fun for a bartender to do that. We want everyone to have a good time, right?
I agree. And I don't like, it's, you know, there are so many drinks that I enjoy drinking that even if I look around and I'm like, I'm at a dive bar and I can get a beer, or maybe I'm like, I don't even know if the wine's going to be like good here, because right. Not every bar should have to do everything. Even if I'm just like, this is a total dive. Which I love dives.
I love dives.
But like my go-tos, you can look at the back bar and like look at the spirits they have. Because a dive bar will almost always have good spirits.
Yeah.
Like that's pretty standard. They're going to have a top and a mid-shelf. And like a mid-shelf tequila and soda with like a lime twist.
Perfect.
That's great. A mid-shelf whiskey with soda and a splash of ginger ale. Mm-hmm. I like that. It's like not too sweet. It's going to be something. So I think, you know, like those one-in-ones like with a good spirit. If you want to drink something that's not going to give you a headache, that's, you know, going to be quality, upgrade your spirit choice and mix it with some soda.
Yeah, that sounds great. That's a great suggestion. Yeah. I love that. All right. Our last question of the evening comes from Rouge Goat. Thanks again.
Rogue Rouge.
Rogue Rouge. It is Rouge. It's spelled Rouge. It's the French. Rouge Goat asks, you've been doing this podcast for about a year now. What is your favorite thing you've learned from researching for this podcast? Are there any things that came up in past episodes that you want to revisit?
I'm going to answer the first part, and then I'm going to let Liz answer the first part. For me, my favorite thing that I've learned, I don't know why this is stuck in my head, but I loved learning about NASCAR's connection to moonshining.
Yes.
For anyone that hasn't listened to that episode, the quick review is that NASCAR came directly from people like tricking out their cars to outrun cops when they were moonshiners and like trying to get across the border to other states. And,
that's so cool.
Yeah. So I've been thinking about that fact a lot recently because, you know, we had like NASCAR who outlawed the Confederate flag, which I think is mm-hmm. great. And had, you know, solidarity with one of their black racers. And anyone that was like, oh, like, NASCAR is for the Americans. Like, it's like, NASCAR's roots are in, like, the resistance of, like, law enforcement. So I think, like, you know, it's weird how you can learn about something and it can just completely change not just your opinion on it, but, like, the truth of the matter.
Yeah.
Like, that NASCAR was founded by people rebelling against law enforcement.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's beautiful. Yeah. I love that answer. Nice answer. Mm-hmm. That's great. Mine is bees.
Don't tell the bees.
I love bees.
Maybe this is a very be positive podcast.
It is. I'll always be positive. I like bugs in general, but I liked learning about bees in our mead episode, and it inspired me to learn more about bees. I like weird science and nature facts, so that's what, like, consistently my favorite part in researching all of the stuff we do is, like, kind of, like, the weird science-y things that mm-hmm. go into making booze. And then also, of course, like, the weird history. Like, I mean, Hildegard von Bingen having migraines and, like, everyone thinking she's having visions, which is great. Well, maybe she has visions. I don't know.
Maybe both.
I like science. Mm. And I like bees. So,
you like science? I like bees.
So my answer is bees.
Are there any things that came up in past episodes that you want to revisit?
Bees. I want to revisit
the bees.
You just
want to go back to the bees. Just more bees. More bee content. More bees.
That's what y'all want, right? Fine. More bees all the time.
I'm fine with that. I'm always fine with more bees. There are a lot of things that we've talked about that, like, I feel like in my alcohol education, a lot of the early episodes were getting things out of my system that I always intended to go back and research. Mm-hmm. But now that we've gotten through more, there's just like this next layer. There are always like the prominent spirits in a culture that I don't feel like I know enough about. And then, you know, we do the research and we learn about it, and that's really cool. But then there's like the next tier.
Yeah.
Of, like, you know, and a lot of the, like, some of the episodes where we've done, where we've talked about one specific, like, drinking culture and one specific spirit from that. It's like, I want to go back again and like, okay, so we talked to you about Baijiu, but let's talk about everything else that, yeah, that people drink in China that's not, like, readily known outside of the nation. So
yeah.
I always think there's that, like, digging deeper. Like, I want to know the weirdest, most obscure spirit, like,
yeah,
in every culture.
One thing I feel like is really consistent with everything that we've covered, I never feel like, oh, well, we've already done that, so we can't talk about this because that's too close to that. Like, we know, like, if there's something else that we can, like, dig a little deeper in there, I'm really interested in it.
Well, that really goes to, like, the topic that we're, I mean, talking about alcohol as a history, as a whole, we'll never be able to pin down the facts. However hard we try, so much of what we talk about is myth, is legend, is hearsay. And I think that does seem frustrating at times,
yeah,
but it also makes it really fascinating because there are things we'll be researching completely different topics, and it gives light to something that we talked about months ago, but it also contradicts something that we talked about months ago.
And
it's
absolutely,
like, what's true? It's like, maybe all of it. Who knows? Maybe none of it. Mm-hmm. It's just a constantly expanding. There's no straight line through history for any of this stuff. It's just kind of learning different pieces of a big puzzle that forms the culture of booze.
Yes. I love that. I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
That was all the questions that we had that we were going to answer today. We will be answering more questions in the future, but we are going to put a little pin in that. And, you know, we got a lot of really cool questions. As Taylor said, there are going to be some that kind of warrant, like we couldn't talk about this without just, like, going into this whole deep dive on this subject. So we're going to be definitely working in some of these really interesting questions into other episodes.
Thank you all for sending your questions. This was a really great round of Q&A, so thank you.
Do check out the video companion to this episode. It's going to be up on YouTube. We'll put the link to it in our Twitter.
We're going to confound ourselves further with Pim's cups.
Yes. Yeah. I'm really excited about this because I really didn't have any knowledge of Pim's cups before, and now I'm going to learn all of the different ways that a Pim's cup can be a Pim's cup. So please join us for that, and thank you so much. Thank you to Absurdist for our theme music. Thank you to everybody who sent in questions, everybody who's interacted with us on Twitter. You can find us at Neat Boozecast on Twitter and Instagram. And yeah,
I've been Taylor Smurl,
and I've been Liz June,
and this has been
Neat.